The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, today for the show, we're going to be going back and running through some fairly recent history just on the moral decline of the United States. And, of course, you could add Great Britain into the mix as well. Just the decay, the total collapse, really, of our traditional values. And it just keeps going lower and lower and lower with each passing election cycle. A few weeks after, this takes us back to the late 1990s, a few weeks after President Clinton's impeachment trial. This was in early 1999. Paul Weyrich, the co-founder of the Heritage Foundation, a fairly prominent voice in the conservative community, he wrote at the end of 1999, or early in 99, that the conservative movement in America had, for all intents and purposes, failed. He said, I no longer believe that there's a moral majority. I do not believe that a majority of Americans actually share our values. We're in the minority now, he was saying. He said if we had a majority, well, President Clinton, for all that he did there in the 1990s, would have been driven out of office. Later on, Weyrich said, the ideology of political correctness, which openly calls for the destruction of our traditional culture, has so gripped the body politic, has so gripped our institutions, that it's even affecting the church. It has completely taken over the academic community. It's now pervasive in the entertainment industry, and it threatens to control literally every aspect of our lives. Further on, he said, the culture we are living in becomes an ever wider sewer. Again, he's writing this in 1999. In truth, he said, I think that we're caught up in a cultural collapse of historic proportions, a collapse so great that it simply overwhelms politics. I don't have all the answers, he said, or even all the questions, but I know that what we have been doing for 30 years hasn't worked. And while we have been fighting and winning in politics, our culture has decayed into something approaching barbarism. They had been fighting and winning in politics. I mean, Republicans can still, on occasion, win the presidency or gain an advantage in the House or in the Senate. In fact, a year after Weyrich made this, some would say, startling admission, George W. Bush won his bid for the White House, although it was, well, you know the story with the 2000 election. He barely won. But the Republicans did gain control of both houses of Congress. And so the Republicans swept into power. And many in the conservative movement viewed Mr. Weyrich at the time as, well, he's a defeatist. He's a pessimist. He puts up the white flag, and then a year later, we take over the House. We take over the Senate. We take over the White House. George W. Bush came into office early on in 2001, and of course, that was the year of the 9/11 attack. Just 8 years, or rather 8 months into office. That's how the Islamists greeted the new president. And of course, after that attack in the United States, I mean, God, well, we talked about some of this yesterday. God was everywhere. I mean, he was on signs. He was in songs. He was talked about at school, at sporting events, even in government. Both parties in Congress gathered together on the steps of the Capitol after 9/11 to sing God Bless America. I mean, this seemed like a religious revival. In 2004, you might recall, just a few years later, President Bush was reelected. He won that election a little more easily than he did in 2000. And if you remember, the major media, they were horrified at Mr. Bush's reelection because in their minds, America had turned into a radically religious, ultra-conservative nation. The left was so scared that some liberals were talking of immigrating to Canada. Some others produced a red Jesus land map to show how America was governed by a right-wing theocracy. That's the way they viewed it. Jesus land! It's sweeping the nation! And all of this, for the most part, was based on a misleading question in an exit poll during that presidential election that supposedly found that most Americans based their vote on moral values more than any other single issue. And so that frightened the left. Moral values? What are we doing? Are we returning to the 50s? Are we going backwards? Well, had the survey been worded the right way, as one columnist pointed out at the time, in actual fact, moral values would have come in dead last. It would have come in last place. As we wrote at thetrumpet.com at the time, this is from December 2004, the blue states have already won the cultural battle, notwithstanding the media's shameless attempt to cram the secular agenda even further down our throats. That's why conservatives ignored the moral values platform this past election cycle. That was in 2004. How much do you hear in the election cycle today? How much do you hear about moral values, traditional values, constitutional law, the rule of law? Paul Weyrich was, as it turns out, he was right. In 1999, a Republican might have won the White House the year later or the year after that, but San Francisco values had overwhelmed politics. And during the Bush years, the cultural collapse in America, it just was, it got worse. 2006 midterm elections, remember that? The Democrats then swept to power, led by a radical leftist from San Francisco. And they took hold of Capitol Hill in a landslide. My father at the time warned that those midterm elections had changed American politics forever. He said in a 2006 article that you don't even need a deep biblical understanding to realize where this nation, where the United States is headed. That's what we were talking about in 2006. And of course, this was 2 years before a majority of Americans handed the White House over to the most radical leftist president in the history of the United States. And then today, I mean, look at the sorts of moral questions that we're considering, like whether or not a man who feels like he's a woman should be able to go into the woman's restroom. That's the cause of the day that we've got to stake out a position on. Just look at the things that we're considering today. Look at the debate, the things we debate today. and see how far America has fallen. Charles Krauthammer, he wrote earlier this year, I think this was the day after or soon after Donald Trump essentially won the nomination. I think it came down to Indiana was the last state that Ted Cruz was pinning his hopes on. And Krauthammer had this to say after Trump won Indiana. He said, "What makes Indiana a truly historic inflection point, or rather, which makes Indiana," I'm picking it up in the middle of a thought, "it makes it a truly historic inflection point. It marks the most radical transformation of the political philosophy of a major political party in our lifetime. The Democrats continue their trajectory of ever-expansive liberalism from the New Deal through the Great Society, through Obama and Clinton today, while the GOP, the nation's conservative party, its ideology refined and crystallized by Ronald Reagan, has just gone populist. It's an ideological earthquake. How radical a reorientation," said Trump last week. This is from May, quoting Trump. "Folks, I'm a conservative, but at this point, who cares? Well, yes, I'm a conservative, but at this point, who really cares?" I mean, he brings up a pretty good point, I'd say. Who really cares about conservatism? Who really cares about those bedrock principles of small government, of liberty, of fiscal responsibility, of the Constitution and the rule of law? Conservative values, who cares? Religion and morality? Come on, who cares? At this point, who cares?" He sounded somewhat like Mrs. Clinton from a few years back. What difference does it make? At this point, I mean, what difference does it make? Who cares? Another conservative commentator, writing at about the same time that Weyrich wrote that statement or gave that statement about conservatism in 1999. This is Paul Johnson in an article we have quoted from often, the one about no law without order, no freedom without law. He said the essence of the rule of law is its impersonality, omnipotence, and ubiquity. It's the same law for everyone, everywhere. Kings, emperors, high priests, the state itself are subject to it. If exceptions are made, the rule of law begins to collapse. That was the grand lesson of antiquity. That was the grand lesson of history. That if you make exceptions to the rule of law, then the whole system begins to collapse. It's a slippery slope. Johnson says, both in Virginia and in New England to the north, the colonists were determined, God-fearing men, often in search of religious toleration denied them at home, who brought their families and were anxious to farm and establish permanent settlements. They put political and religious freedom before riches. He says, finally, thus took shape the economic dynamo that eventually became the United States, an experiment, note this, designed to establish the rule of God on earth. What a noble goal that was. To establish the rule of God on earth. And so it was built up. I mean, the foundation was the Judeo-Christian ethic. Principles, laws, founding documents based upon great principles of the Bible. Well, you look at what some of the founders said. You can see why Johnson wrote what he did in 1999. At the very beginning, George Washington said the foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality. Religion and morality, he said in his farewell address, are the indispensable supports of American society. Without it, without religion, without morality, without the rule of law, this experiment, and that's what it was, as Paul Johnson said, this experiment would be doomed to fail. John Adams, the second president of the United States, he said, "Statesmen may plan and speculate for liberty, but it is religion and morality alone which can establish the principles upon which freedom can securely stand." Religion and morality. You go back far enough and you see how the country was established, the United States, that is. And it's no wonder there weren't, well, really, it's a wonder there weren't more people writing what Paul Weyrich wrote a lot earlier than 1999. He took quite a bit of flack for writing that in 99 from the Republican side, from the conservative wing. What are you doing? We haven't lost yet. Well, you're giving up. We're still fighting. We're still fighting in this cultural war. And he said there in 99, "Look, we've been overwhelmed. We may get a Republican in office now and again, but look at the direction. Look at the educational institutions. Look at popular culture. Look at the popular causes of the day. Look at the things that we gather to debate about." When we come back, we'll go back a little bit further to the 1980s, some of the statements that President Reagan had to say about religion and morality, and you'll see where he was just echoing what the founders had said. And then we'll look at another voice that was sounding an alarm even before the era of the 1980s, the so-called golden age of conservatism. All that and more when we come back. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
In some of the reading I've been doing over the last couple of months about Ronald Reagan and his administration there during the 1980s and some of the things that happened with America during that decade, I have been fascinated to just see some of the parallels between President Reagan as he led the United States and Herbert W. Armstrong as he was leading God's church. Both of those men did their greatest work late in life, when they were very old, into their 70s and 80s, even into the 90s, in Mr. Armstrong's case. Both men worked tirelessly to get the nation and to get God's church, you could say, back on track during the 1980s. And in the case of Mr. Armstrong, this is maybe one of a few areas where the analogy or the parallel, I guess, breaks down. But after spending 7 years getting the church back on track, this was during the 1980s, in 1985, just a few months before he died, Mr. Armstrong concluded that most in the church just didn't get it.
There is a reason why we're the first fruits. And I wish I could drive that home. But I fear that most of you just don't get it. You don't understand it at all. Why? Why are we the first fruits? I'm going to try to make it plain this afternoon, and still I think you won't get it.
I'm going to try to make it plain. And he did speak plainly. And yet still, he thought, most in the church wouldn't get it. The church, in case you don't know a lot about that history, there had been an incredible resurgence, an explosion of growth. And yet, Mr. Armstrong, right there at the end of his life, he concluded, you don't get it. Most of you don't get it. And he was right. That's the thing. He was right. Because after his death, well, we saw an entire church fall away from the truth. Now, in the case of President Reagan, he remained optimistic about America's future and the direction it was headed right up to the end of his life. And so it's a little bit different, as I say. But when you consider some of these next clips that I'll play for you, you do have to wonder, did America as a whole, did America really get it? Because here was a leader who came along and spoke plainly, spoke powerfully. He was the great communicator. That's what he's known as. And he really did believe what the founders believed about religion and morality. This is from a speech that Mr. Reagan gave in the second campaign for president. Well, he did run in 1976 and lost, but he won in 1980. And then in 1984, he's running again for re-election against Walter Mondale. And this speech here comes right in the heat of the campaign season. So it's August 23rd, 1984. So he's basically two months away from the election. And this is how the President of the United States was talking. This is what he was speaking about just before a presidential election. This is clip one.
I believe that faith and religion play a critical role in the political life of our nation and always have. And that the church, and by that I mean all churches, all denominations, has had a strong influence on the state, and this has worked to our benefit as a nation. Those who created our country, the founding fathers and mothers, understood that there is a divine order which transcends the human order. They saw the state, in fact, as a form of moral order, and felt that the bedrock of moral order is religion. The Mayflower Compact began with the words, "In the name of God, amen." The Declaration of Independence appeals to nature's God and the Creator and the Supreme Judge of the world. Congress was given a chaplain, and the oaths of office are oaths before God. James Madison in the Federalist Papers admitted that in the creation of our republic, he perceived the hand of the Almighty. John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, warned that we must never forget the God from whom our blessings flow. George Washington referred to religion's profound and unsurpassed place in the heart of our nation quite directly in his farewell address in 1796. 7 years earlier, France had erected a government that was intended to be purely secular. This new government would be grounded on reason rather than the law of God. By 1796, the French Revolution had known the reign of terror. And Washington voiced reservations about the idea that there could be a wise policy without a firm moral and religious foundation. He said, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man call himself a patriot who would labor to subvert these finest props of the duties of men and citizens. The mere politician and the pious man ought to respect and to cherish religion and morality." And he added, "Let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion."
That's President Reagan speaking in Dallas, I believe it was, at Reunion Arena, before a huge crowd, a huge gathering, talking about these indispensable supports, saying that the politician should respect and cherish religion and morality. He quoted from the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who warned that we should never forget God. He talked about America's founding documents, the Mayflower Compact, the Declaration of Independence, all of these institutions, all of these traditions, all of these references to God and the Bible and religion. Those who created our country understood. They understood that there's a divine order which transcends the human order. That God rules over all. What are we without that foundation, that bedrock of morality and religion? Well, as you heard there, particularly that quote from the second inaugural, his farewell address from 1796. I love the way he set that up, comparing it to France. Okay, so France set out to build a government that was intended to be purely secular. And what did that get them? In just a few years, a reign of terror. And then he goes on from that to quote Washington in that farewell address, saying, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." That's a statement that we've used often. You can read it in our literature, like Character in Crisis. Well, going back to this speech, this is August 23rd, 1984, President Reagan speaking in Dallas, clip 2.
Religion played not only a strong role in our national life, it played a positive role. The abolitionist movement was at heart a moral and religious movement. So was the modern civil rights struggle. And throughout this time, the state was tolerant of religious belief, expression, and practice. Society, too, was tolerant. But in the 1960s, this began to change. We began to make great steps towards secularizing our nation and removing religion from its honored place. In 1962, the Supreme Court, in the New York prayer case, banned the compulsory saying of prayers. In 1963, the court banned the reading of the Bible in our public schools. From that point on, the courts pushed the meaning of the ruling ever outward, so that now our children are not allowed voluntary prayer.
It's a slippery slope, as he explains there. And you compare that 1962 ruling, the 1963 ruling he brings up, with John Jay, as he mentioned in that first clip that I played, who said that we should never forget God. Never forget. That's a pretty amazing contrast. Never forget God, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court said. And then in the 1960s, you had Supreme Court justices making their voice heard that we should get rid of prayer, that we should eliminate Bible reading, that this should have nothing to do with education. He's referring back to history, the early 1960s, and of course Reagan here is speaking in 1984, and he said, since those rulings, the courts have pushed the meaning of the ruling ever outward. They keep advancing with their radical leftist secularist agenda. It never stops. It never concludes as Weyrich concluded, you know, from the other side in 1999, that, well, we've lost, we've been overwhelmed. That's not the way the secular progressives think. There's always territory that they need to claim. It needs to keep pushing ever outward. And that's what happened from 1962 through to 1984. And Reagan came along hoping to change the direction of America. And, you know, to some extent he did. But did it lead to a spiritual awakening across the nation? Did it lead to a moral revival of biblical standards? Well, let me play a few more clips here. Again, this is from 1984, President Reagan, clip 4.
The truth is, politics and morality are inseparable. And as morality's foundation is religion, religion and politics are necessarily related. We need religion as a guide. We need it because we are imperfect. And our government needs the church because only those humble enough to admit they're sinners can bring to democracy the tolerance it requires in order to survive. A state is nothing more than a reflection of its citizens. The more decent the citizens, the more decent the state.
That's certainly a message you don't hear today. Politics and morality being inseparable. The fact that we need religion as a guide. Because we're imperfect. Because we're sinners. We need God's direction. We need God to show us the way. We need the lamp of God's truth to light our paths. This was just a little over 30 years ago. A sitting president of the United States running for re-election. 1984. Here's another, clip 5.
We establish no religion in this country, nor will we ever. We command no worship. We mandate no belief, but we poison our society when we remove its theological underpinnings. We court corruption when we leave it bereft of belief. All are free to believe or not to believe. All are free to practice a faith or not. But those who believe must be free to speak of and act on their belief, to apply moral teaching to public questions.
There's the president essentially urging the theologians of his day, the clergy, to speak out and to apply moral teaching to public questions, to lead in the debate. We need you. We need religion and morality. Without these theological underpinnings, as he called them there, well, we have no foundation. We have no foundation. This experiment can't last. He'll say that pretty much directly. A little bit later on in the speech, I'll play it for you. First here, clip 6.
Without God, there is no virtue because there's no prompting of the conscience. Without God, we're mired in the material, that flat world that tells us only what the senses perceive. Without God, there is a coarsening of the society. And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure. If we ever forget that we're one nation under God, then we will be a nation gone under.
That's quite a warning. And if he was right, what does it mean for America's future? I mean, here we are 30 plus years on, and you look at where we are today, and what I just played for you, it does not in any way disagree with what the founders believed. That if we're without God, this democracy experiment, this republic cannot endure. If we're not a nation under God, we're a nation going under. That's right in line with what the founders believed, as he noted earlier himself in that speech. Well, as we come near to the conclusion of it, this kind of sounds similar to clips I've played for you before, where Reagan talked about just how much religion and morality and the example of presidents before him and their prayers to God, how it really impacted him as the president of the United States. This is clip 7.
If I could just make a personal statement of my own, in these 3.5 years, I have understood and known better than ever before the words of Lincoln when he said that he would be the greatest fool on this footstool called Earth if he ever thought that for one moment he could perform the duties of that office without help from one who is stronger than all.
Lincoln couldn't do it without God's help. Reagan was saying there he couldn't do it without God's help, without help from one who's stronger than all. And then he says here, finally, one final admonition to the people of America. This is clip 8.
Thank you for your kindness and your patience. May God keep you, and may we, all of us, keep God. Thank you.
So you know where Reagan stood. He wanted to be with God. He wanted God's help. He wanted to acknowledge God's hand in the Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence, in the establishment of the United States. He wanted religion and morality to underpin American culture. But the question is, did these many heartfelt messages, there's quite a few of them, speeches like this, I mean, did they lead to a spiritual revival in the United States? Well, along the way, I think there's quotes from Reagan to suggest that he believed it was leading to a revival. And there's commentators from that time who believe the same thing. Well, Reagan's a conservative. This is the golden age. He's won 2 terms. In another speech that he gave that same year, I don't have audio clips from it, but it's one that he gave soon after that one you just heard, September the 5th, 1984. He talked about a new revolution is rising from the deepest yearnings of our nation's spirit to challenge the limits of knowledge and to put the power of discovery at the service of our most noble and generous impulses for decency, for progress, and yes, for peace. So he did talk about just this innovative spirit and the push to modernize, to build, to construct. But within this speech, again, he talked about religion and morality, in particular, those moral underpinnings. He said, "My friends, we can create a bounty of new opportunities, technologies, and improvements." And he talks about, again, some of the progress that could be made, and that America could be, as he said, a rocket of hope, shooting to the stars. And then he said this, "In the past few decades, many of us turned away from the enduring values, from faith, the work ethic, and the central importance of the family." He said, "We had something of a hedonistic heyday, but it's passing," Mr. Reagan said. "It's passing. We've righted ourselves. And across the country, there's a rebirth of the traditional values that guided our fathers and mothers and guided our nation." That was his assessment, that we were turning a corner. And as I say, there were others at that time who agreed with him. There was a well-known conservative voice, Alan Carlson, Dr. Carlson, back in the day, the president of the Rockford Institute. He gave a speech at Hillsdale College, the one in Michigan, and he asked about America's national self-confidence and how we can understand its decline and how we can support its renewal. So first he talked about the decline and all of the negative influences and how traditional values had come under attack from the secularists. And he says that religious values motivated the broad generation of men and women who created this nation, similar to what Reagan said, those founding fathers and mothers that established the nation. And then later he said, "I believe it's a mistake to assume that a national culture can openly flaunt hedonism and social irresponsibility as proper, even superior, ways of life and not then pay some major price. We can't just accommodate and openly flaunt hedonism." It's the same word that Mr. Reagan used in that September speech, that we've had something of a hedonistic heyday. Dr. Carlson said, "In countless ways, we're now reaping the bitter harvest. And so we do reap what we sow. Whatever a man sows, the Bible says, that's what he'll reap. We'll receive the fruit of our doing," the prophet Isaiah wrote. But notice the conclusion here. This is from Dr. Carlson's speech at Hillsdale back in 1984. I think he gave this in January 1984. So this was the election year, the same year that those two speeches were given by the president. Dr. Carlson says, "So what's to be done? As I've tried to show, the critical battles have been and are being fought in the world of ideas. During the 1960s and 70s, the defenders of property, family, and religious values were clearly on the defensive and even routed at times. But during the 1980s, I'm pleased to report that is no longer the case. I think it's clear to most observers that the other side stands today as intellectually and morally bankrupt. Only its control of the major levers of opinion making continues to hide that fact." Well, they still control a lot of the levers of power, but now they've been exposed as morally bankrupt. Now we've got a strong conservative in office. We've turned the tide. In the 60s and 70s, those who were defending the traditional family and religious values, they were on the defensive. They were backpedaling, at times routed. But in the 1980s, Dr. Carlson was pleased to report that that was no longer the case. But going back to the Bible verse that he paraphrased, reaping what we sow. And now we're 30 years on. And carrying on with that analogy, Jesus added to what Paul said, that you will know them by their fruits. By their fruits, you shall know them. You're going to know them. Well, really, there wasn't much of a nationwide revival to speak of at all in the 1980s. In looking back at some of the old plain truths, Herbert Armstrong's magazine, the February 1985 issue, I mean, this was when the circulation was upwards of 7-8 million. A lot of people received this message. A lot of Republicans and conservatives, no doubt. And some that maybe didn't appreciate it so much. It's from an article, February 1985, as I say, The Plain Truth by Gene Hogberg, one of Mr. Armstrong's writers in the news bureau there, writing about the truth behind America's moral crisis. He, too, talks about the all-out assault on spiritual values, the assault on the family, and how that we're reaping what we've sown. Notice this quote in particular. Mr. Hogberg said, the United States, he's writing this in February 1985. He says, the United States at the moment is experiencing an upsurge in national pride and confidence. But this is largely superficial, fueled primarily by economic optimism. It's largely superficial. I mean, in the office of the White House, you had a pretty good man. One of the best presidents of the 20th century, if not the best. But there was no nationwide spiritual revival. There was an upsurge in optimism, in national pride. I mean, President Reagan was building up the military. Billions and billions of dollars going toward it. He was standing up to the Soviet Union. The economy was surging. But there was no corresponding upsurge in morality. The Wall Street Journal, Mr. Hogberg's article, it quotes an editorial from the Wall Street Journal at the time, March 20th, 1984, talking about the moral decay in America that had set in over the previous two decades. And as it happens, the journal placed a lot of the blame right at the doorstep of mainstream religion, traditional Christianity. They weren't standing up for biblical principles regarding family and family values. It says here, this is quoting the Wall Street Journal, basically what happened is that the new morality of big cities such as New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, does this sound familiar? It was imposed on the rest of the country by movies, TV, magazines, advertising, music, novelists, playwrights, and through default, by organized religion. Religion had its part to play in this defeat, in being overwhelmed by secularism. Quoting the article later, this is the Wall Street Journal from March of 1984. It says, but outside the evangelical and fundamentalist communities, that help never arrived. See, the church needed help. The evangelical and fundamentalist communities, they needed help. Because, well, as it says, the church doors are open every Sunday, but unhappily for those who enter, much contemporary American theology has come to be based in this period on a kind of dainty religious mush that has more in common with the sentiments of Rod McCune and John Lennon than the precepts of Isaiah or the Apostle John. That's the Wall Street Journal writing in 1984, 15 years or so before Paul Weyrich came along and admitted that conservatism is dead. And yet, if you want to go back before Mr. Weyrich's statement, if you want to go back before that Wall Street Journal piece that the Plain Truth quoted in 1984, you can go all the way back to the early 1960s when those seeds were planted, to use Dr. Carlson's analogy, which he got from the Apostle Paul. When those seeds were planted, it was Herbert Armstrong. Herbert Armstrong alone who was talking about the moral collapse of the United States of America. It's in his book, God Speaks Out, on the New Morality. This is the early text that later became The Missing Dimension in Sex. People are more familiar with that title. But the first version, intended to be a textbook at Ambassador College, used as a textbook at God's College. God Speaks Out on the New Morality. Mr. Armstrong wrote, he had a team of authors that helped him assemble the material in that book, but in the book early on he says, look, when it started to swing coming out of the post-World War II period, or coming out of World War II and the post-war relaxation of morals, as he said, if any sector of society would be able to stand firm and to hold up those religious and moral underpinnings, certainly it would be religion. Certainly it would be traditional Christianity. But as he brings out and God Speaks Out on the New Morality, instead of holding up those moral standards, religion absolutely caved in to worldliness, to pressure coming from the world. He says, this is on page 24, the ministers of the gospel were inoculated with the evolutionary serum in their pre-seminary college years. The seminary professors were themselves the victims of anti-God German rationalism absorbed in their student days. More and more theological institutions were sending into pulpits young ministers addicted to modernism, and they were becoming increasingly broad-minded in their attitude towards sex and marriage. And so when the New Morality exploded onto the scene in the middle of the 20th century, at a time when God's voice should have been loud and clear, the only place you heard that voice was in the Plain Truth magazine, the World Tomorrow radio program, and later the World Tomorrow television show. Page 109, God Speaks Out on the New Morality. Where does God Almighty pin the guilt for this moral collapse? He pins it squarely on the world's clergy, the theologians, the priests, the rectors, the ministers, the preachers. They ought to be society's moral leaders. They've forsaken the Creator God and have become society's followers. You see, instead of overcoming the world, these many denominations in the traditional Christian world were overcome by the world. And that in itself proves where God's true church was at the time. Look at the one that was crying aloud. long before Paul Weyrich ever came along, long before the Wall Street Journal finally spoke up in the 80s and said, what is happening? What's happened to our educational institutions? What's happened to religion? What's happened to our popular culture? What's happened in politics? Well, Mr. Armstrong was sounding the alarm. It's a strong message in God Speaks Out on the new morality. And he said in that book, I know there's going to be people, even in the religious community, even in the world of traditional Christianity, that are going to come forward and persecute me for what I write in this book. But as he went on to write, it needs to be said, this is God's perspective. This is God's view. This is God's position. This is God's truth. It's a shame that more people, even within his own church, didn't heed that warning message. It's a shame that more people in the United States of America didn't heed his warning message, and even the warnings that President Reagan was sounding. Well, it's some fascinating history, as I say, with some fascinating parallels, an interesting time, for sure. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on kpcg.fm. Don't forget to email us, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.